Firstly, what motivated you to become an economic historian and explore immigration?
Well, I originally started out interested in labor economics when I was an undergraduate. And then it seemed to me like all of the programs that were under consideration for evaluation, like job training programs, for example, which were a subject of great consideration in the 80s and 90s, seemed to stem out of some sort of a history. Like there had been a large manufacturing sector in certain cities. That sector had been declining, and now there were workers in need of new job training. And so I got intrigued by the long-run history that was hiding behind some of the contemporary policies that were under consideration in labor economics. So I wanted to learn more about what economic historians do. When I was in grad school, I had the great opportunity to work with a group of both economic historians and labor economists, including my main advisor, Claudia Golden and Larry Katz. So I was able to sort of meld the two of those.
Awesome. Sounds great. So jumping into some of your work, you recently published a book called Streets of Gold: America's Untold Story of Immigrant Success. So firstly, we would love to understand, why does popular perception tend to differ so much from the mountain of evidence surrounding the benefits of immigration?
Well, this is work that I've been engaged with for probably 10, 15 years now with my longtime collaborator, Ron Abramitsky, and also with a number of co-authors. So I do want to give a shout out to all of them first. And we had the sense, as we started writing the book, Ron and I, that immigration policy and attitudes towards immigrants tend to be driven more by anecdotes rather than by data. And so it's easy to pick out one person out of the 44 million immigrants living in the US and either hold that person up for their great achievements, whether it's someone in science, innovation, in business, a CEO, or hold them up for some kind of horrific event that they have participated in. It could be terrorism, could be crime. And people are very swayed by those individual stories, but the stories may not reflect the data. And so we thought, well, we would really like to get some of the data that we've been working on for so long out in front of the public. Surely people are still quite influenced by stories and by individuals that they meet, but maybe if they take a look at some of the trends in the data, it's a possibility that people might change their views, at least on the margin.
Awesome. And there was a lot of interesting data in that book. Could you give us some insight into how machine learning was used to trace individuals and compile the data that was utilized in your book? In general, what avenues for future research do you think big data can open up?
So let's start with the data itself, which is historical census records. The census is, a full accounting of all of the residents of the population. And we have detailed economic questions about residents going back to around 1850. We also have all the information about their identity. We have their first name, their last name, the address where they're living, who else is living in the households with them. And in order for us to use that data as a data set, the data needs to be digitized because originally it was collected in manuscript form. That part of the project we did not do ourselves. I mean, that would be prohibitive for any individual or research team to do. And we really do need to give thanks to many volunteers from particularly the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, who've collected and digitized this data. But it was not intended as a data set. It was intended as a resource for genealogists who wanted to look up family members. And so, what we've added to this, and we've been working on this for years, but so have other research teams, is various approaches for trying to link an individual over time. So if you see someone living in the US in 1900, could you find the same person in 1910? Well, we don't know for sure because we don't have an identity number, like a social security number written down in the census. But we can try to make some educated guesses based on information that is unlikely to change over time, like your name, your first name, your last name, like your age, which will reveal your birth year, and like the state or the country in which you're born. We actually ourselves don't use a lot of machine learning. We use a procedural algorithm instead with a set of rules. But there are other research teams that do use machine learning for this. If you're planning on using machine learning, what you would do is have a training data set where you have humans making choices about potential links. And then you will use machine learning to scale up those choices into an algorithm. Instead, we have an algorithm that has a set of rules to follow in terms of who to match to whom. But we continue to innovate on this. We have two new projects that we're working on right now about different aspects of census matching. Honestly, I never thought when I got into this 15 years ago that I would still be working on census matching, that it would be as fascinating as it has been. But it's really continuing to be a burgeoning field.
And in the information that you have gathered so far, what were some of the highlights that you discovered personally?
You mean in terms of the findings for it, with the research that comes out of this type of approach?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think the some of the findings that have emerged really surprised me and were contrary to my priors. And those are always the most interesting ones. What I have in mind are two different measures of immigrant assimilation and how immigrant assimilation has changed over a century. So the first measure is how the children of immigrants are faring in the labor market relative to their parents, moving up the economic ladder. I guess my prior going into this research is that immigrants who arrived in the US 100 years ago during the Ellis Island generation, who were primarily from Europe, were highly successful. The immigrants themselves, maybe not so much, but their children were able to move up very rapidly, and that somehow immigrants today may not have as many opportunities. Maybe because the structure of the economy has changed, maybe manufacturing jobs were particularly avenues for upward mobility, and now with our service economy and with more income inequality, perhaps those avenues were not open. So my eyes were really opened by what we found, which is actually that the children of immigrants today are moving up at the same pace as the children of immigrants during the Ellis Island era. And that this is true even as you disaggregate countries of origin, so that you're looking at the children whose parents came from some very poor countries today, like Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala. And you look at children who were coming, whose parents came from poor European countries in the past, like from Italy, from Eastern Europe. And you see actually very similar pace of upward mobility in those two time periods. That really surprised me tremendously. And the historical part of that comparison comes from the census data that I just described. I guess the other element of assimilation that surprised me was on the cultural side. There are so many elements of cultural assimilation that one might be able to measure, and certainly we can't capture them all, and we can't capture them all historically. So if we want to compare past and present, we have to limit ourselves to a set of behaviors that we can observe in both time periods. But the one that really caught my eye was when we look at the names that immigrant parents choose for their kids as they spend more time in the United States. Immigrants who have a child after just arriving will tend to give their kids names that look more like the set of names used in the home country. And as they spend more time in the US, they'll start converging towards the names that US-born parents will select. And that process takes time. But again, I went into the research with a prior that somehow in the past, immigrants were much more worried about conformity and about attempting to look American and join American society, whereas today immigrants are okay with the idea of being a hyphenated American, you know, of retaining culture and then, you know, joining American society selectively. But at least according to this names measure, I was totally wrong. It looks like immigrants today are assimilating along this metric at the same pace now as in the past.
How has the concept of the American dream evolved over time? And how, in your opinion, has immigration shaped that evolution?
Well, the American dream is a very challenging and slippery concept to define. So we played around with, you know, and when we were coming up with the title for our book, we kept sort of circling around the idea of the American dream. But we decided to leave it out because we just felt as social scientists, it's so hard to measure effectively. But if you look at the front cover of our book, you'll see of Streets of Gold, you'll see an image of an immigrant family sort of in black and white, reflecting the historical elements of the book, but looking forward across New York Harbor to American soil. And then there's a big rainbow, you know, that's overlaying the soil in front of them. So I do think that this idea of the American dream or of America representing Streets of Gold has been very pervasive throughout history. And it is one that immigrants themselves hold dear. So we went back to read oral histories and stories, memoirs of immigrants from 100 years ago. And they were using Streets of Gold concepts and saying, well, this is my vision of America before I arrived, was that America had Streets of Gold. And then we also read oral histories and memoirs and interviews from immigrants today. And they use many of the same terms and tropes in talking about their movement to America. So I do think that even though it's quite difficult to define, this concept of the American dream or America reflecting Streets of Gold has been a very pervasive part of an immigrant experience.
What can US policymakers learn from the history of immigration in terms of both incentivizing immigration and also helping immigrants improve their lives while they're in the US?
Well, I think the main lesson that can be taken away from our book is that the immigrants that are arriving in the US these days are succeeding at the same pace as the immigrants from 100 years ago. And so we often hear politicians making implicit historical claims, implicit comparisons with the Ellis Island period. And in those comparisons, today's immigrants usually come out not looking so good. And so you might hear this kind of rhetoric on the right. So President Trump was very famous for saying, I wish we had more immigrants from Norway these days, like we did in the past, rather than the immigrants from the countries that we do receive migrants from. But you can also hear this on the left, though the rationale for why immigrants these days aren't doing as well will be different. And it turns out that both sides are wrong on this. You know, immigrants today are doing well. And if we think that immigration was good in the past and immigration helped build American cities and the American economy, it's still good today. So I know it's a very broad lesson. It's not a specific lesson to say, well, we should pass this policy or that policy. But I do think it's a strong hesitation against changing the status quo by cutting immigration slots, by radically altering the system, which certainly we've heard proposed.
Do you think immigration in America right now is broken?
Well, I think that America is facing polarization on so many topics, and immigration is one of those topics. And so this is something that we cover at the end of our book, and work that Ron and I have been doing with a set of linguists and computer scientists. to try to analyze the congressional record. So we actually have the full text of everything that's been said on the floor of the House and the Senate, going back to, we analyze back to 1870. And we can pick out the speeches that are related to immigration. And then we can compare Republicans and Democrats on those speeches. And it turns out that the two parties were nearly identical in their attitudes towards immigration until around 1970. And since then, there's been ever-growing polarization on this topic. And if you look at the level of the individual speakers, you can say, okay, maybe on average there's polarization, but is there anyone there in the middle between the two party extremes? And it used to be, if you go back to the 80s, 90s, even 2000s, that there were. There was that set of Republicans who were saying, yeah, immigration's pretty good. Maybe they were pro-business. You know, maybe they thought immigration was part of what it meant to be an American. They had their reasons. And there were also Democrats on the other side who were anti-immigration, and they had their reasons as well. These days, though, that middle ground is almost gone. And so we need to change something about the way that we handle immigration policy. But I also think it's within the context of a widening polarization more generally.
I just mentioned that this major change happened since the 1970s. I'm wondering what happened in the 1970s to cause it.
Well, to be very specific, you can start to see this major change occur right after 1965, which is when the border reopened with the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act. And I think what happened, though, this is something we're diving into this summer. So when you say, you know, what I'm going to do on my summer vacation is learn more about what's going on at the individual level. We actually can think about this as a data set of attitudes with individual representatives linked back to their local electorate. But I think what was going on is that the outcomes after the 1965 law were quite unexpected. So the idea was, okay, we're going to eliminate the country-specific quotas that were in place, but we're not going to suddenly start attracting immigration from around the world, because we're going to use a new tool to try to limit immigration to Europe, and that is family reunification. So it used to be, up until 1965, between 1924 and 1965, that there was a specific number of entrants allowed from Italy, a specific number allowed from Poland, and then a specific and nearly zero number allowed from China or other parts of Asia. And that was lifted. But at the same time, politicians did not suddenly want entry from around the world. And so family reunification was used as a substitute, with the idea being, well, who's here already that can send for family members? It's Italians and Portuguese and Poles who arrived in the 1920s. They're now getting quite old. Maybe they can send for a family member, but those family members will all be fellow Europeans. And that is not the way the system ended up working out. I suppose people forgot about some entry from student visas, for example, and then some sponsorship from companies, and then the small nucleus of Asian communities, for example, or communities from Latin America that were able to then use family reunification as well. And if you're a recent immigrant from the early 60s versus a long-standing immigrant from the 1920s, you're more likely to try to use that family reunification system. So I think as soon as the law passed and politicians started to see what the effects might be and started to look down the line to the future, that's where the polarization begins.
You also investigate the phenomenon of white flight in your book, where white families fled to the suburbs during the Great Migration. What were the reasons for this, and did white flight contribute to the racial segregation?
So suburbanization was taking place throughout North America at this time, from 1940 to 70, taking place in Canada as well. And so This is a phenomenon that's not entirely driven by racial dynamics. There is rising incomes and therefore a demand for larger housing units. There's new transportation and interstate highways that made it easier to live out in a bedroom community in a suburb and then drive back in to work in the center city. Eventually, a lot of the jobs also moved out to the suburbs. So the idea of needing to commute back in to the center city eventually started to dissipate, and people could find suburban jobs and suburban residences. So all of these economic factors are going on during this era, and they're going on in the US and in Canada. But there's an added layer of racial dynamics in the US that at the same time as these economic forces are encouraging households to move out to the suburbs, there's also an inflow of rural migrants, rural Black Southern migrants, to center cities. And there are some dynamics going on between white households and Black households within cities that encourage white households to move out to the suburbs. Now, it's not exactly as simple as a Black family moves next door. I don't like the idea of having a Black neighbor, and so I find a white suburb that I can move to. Because within center cities, white and Black households were highly residentially segregated. So even by 1970, even after these 4 million new entrants coming from the South, you could still find many neighborhoods in center cities that were still 99% white. Most of them were not right downtown. They were often out on the periphery of the center city, but they were available. And so the question is, what would push a household not just to a peripheral all-white neighborhood in a city, but over the border into the suburb itself? And so here you have to think about political economy as well, and who's voting with who and who's paying taxes with who and for who. When you think about who's living in the center city, there's a larger and more diverse electorate, both on income grounds and on racial grounds. And they're collecting taxes together and then collectively funding public goods like city schools. If you live in the suburbs, you're going to be in a smaller community, on average richer community, and also on average far more white and racially homogeneous. So because of these political economy forces, there was an added incentive for some white households to actually jump the border, you know, cross over to the other side and live in the suburbs as the city became more racially diverse.
I'm wondering, why is it that within the city, there's areas where mostly Black families live and areas where mostly white families live?
Well, that's going to be a combination of a collective action type barriers and restrictions that make it hard or impossible for Black households to move to white areas, as well as individual mobility decisions. So what I mean by that is, you know, the original Black migrants starting around 1915, part of that first wave of Black migration, were moving up into cities where there was already neighborhoods in place. Some of them are going to be immigrant neighborhoods, a part of that Ellis Island era. Some of them might have predominantly US-born or third or fourth generation families, or some might have a mix. The majority of households there are going to be white. Let's say a Black family tries to move into one of these predominantly white or all white neighborhoods. In many cases, the white families living in those neighborhoods resisted. And they resisted in various ways, some of them quite subtle, like, you know, telling real estate agents who worked in those areas, well, if you ever show a house to a Black family, we won't ever give you business again. So kind of making it very strong incentives on the part of real estate agents to never show a house. But sometimes it was actually also the use of violence and intimidation so that a Black family might move in and then find their house firebombed or picketed or just face intense hostility on the part of neighbors. And so that's the type of collective action that I'm trying to describe that would make it very hard for initial integration to begin. Alternatively, and in addition, so these things happened at the same time. Let's say that this Black migrant moving in around 1915 said, okay, well, I'm going to move to this one or two blocks or, you know, this sort of small area that already has Black residents. Those might be Black residents that had lived in the North for a couple of generations already, and there's just, you know, a couple blocks worth of families, or it could be another recent migrant coming up with me. Well, those blocks are going to abut similar blocks, one or two over, that have white households, and those white households might move out. That might be a matter of distaste of who my neighbor would be. It's not necessarily a matter of fiscal and political economy considerations, but just by moving out, then a new block is going to open up nearby that becomes available for Black households and is more in demand on the part of Black households than on the part of white households who are seeking to avoid that block. And so segregation can emerge that way through some more kind of individual mobility decisions rather than through collective action. But these two things are layered on top of each other. And essentially, once 1940 hits and the mass migration begins, it's already mass migration into a city or set of cities that have residential segregation on the ground.
How can policymakers apply lessons from the Great Migration and white flight to contemporary debates about racial equity and housing policy?
Well, I think that the effects of the Great Migration are not over. And I've learned about this from the work of my colleague, Alora de Renincourt. And so it turns out that kids who were born and raised in cities that had a large Great Black Migration and therefore have a large Black community today are not able to move up in terms of economic mobility as rapidly as kids who were being raised in cities with a smaller Great Black Migration. And this is particularly true of Black kids, and it's particularly true of Black boys rather than Black girls. And so the echoes and after effects of the Great Black Migration are still with us the outcomes of kids who are, again, around my age, born around 1980. So they're still very much contributors or potential contributors to the labor market. And so the fact that these mobility effects are concentrated among Black boys is telling us something about what the potential mechanisms here might be. And so Alora has looked into this, and she's continuing to work on topics along these lines. And there's suggestive evidence that in response to the Great Black Migration and the arrival of new rural Southern Black residents in cities, one response was white flight, but another response at the same time was investment in policing and incarceration. And so for Black boys who are being born and raised into these contexts, those effects are still with us. And so it's not even just a matter of applying lessons from the Great Black Migration for racial equity today. It's actually thinking about how the Great Black Migration is still with us. And we have an opportunity now to potentially undo some of the consequences of the initial backlash and initial response to the migration on the part of white voters and white households.
As you were mentioning, the mechanisms that allowed this stuff to perpetuate so that even today the effects of it are visible. I'm just wondering, can you go into further details as to how these effects still linger on today? And what are the persistent trends that we see in the Black communities today that are indicative of the damage done many decades ago?
Well, I think we'll know more about this after we see Alora's new project. She's been collecting information on municipal regulations. So some of these regulations have to do with, for example, criminalizing different levels of marijuana possession. And we see that there's been a lot of rollback on this in the US, with many states now legalizing marijuana. Some of the regulations have to do with noise violations or vagrancy laws, or rules about maintaining your housing or property to a certain level. And sure, we want to live in neighborhoods that don't have excess noise, that don't have people hanging around on the street corner without a purpose for being there, or, you know, maintaining property and so on. But the question is, what are the penalties associated with these actions? And are the penalties high fines, or even in some cases, jail time, that can send someone's life down a certain path, spiraling in a certain direction? And so we're actually going to see with a lot of granularity, what were the strategies that some of these cities and towns used to try to over-police and criminalize some of the populations that arrived? And can we work systematically to roll some of these back? Keeping in mind that there's some sort of public externality that lawmakers had in mind, sure, and we don't want to roll these laws back without being careful about how we do it, but we also don't want to have these pieces of legislation on the books that are systematically directed to a particular population. So I think there's a lot of work being done on this on the margins. Even in a town like Princeton, there's exploration of our zoning regulations and whether certain areas of town were made particularly dense and other areas of town were made such that you couldn't build more than a single family home. If you had a single family home, you needed to have a very large tract of land in order to make building possible. And there's some question about potentially going back into that history and changing some of the directions that may have originated in this time period. And then they set the foundations for the world that we see around us. And so if that's happening in Princeton, which is a relatively small town and a relatively slow to change type of a place, then I imagine that's going on in communities all over the country. So we do have the opportunity to make changes. We're not set in stone with the history that has been bequeathed to us. And the fact that the kids who are part of Alora's study are actually in their early 40s today means that that history is still very much with us. And it's something that we can re-examine and change.
Finally, something we asked every economist on the podcast: what gives you hope?
Interestingly enough, it relates very much to this last question. History gives me hope, because when I look back over the past century, I notice such enormous change that sometimes when I feel a bit hopeless about change and I think, well, we're stuck in this world of polarization that we've described, we're stuck in this world of petty municipal violations that are targeted towards one population or another. You know, we're stuck with the cities that we find ourselves in that are segregated by virtue of our history. You know, when I feel like there's a lack of change and hope for new options, I look back to history and see indeed how much things have changed over the past century. You know, if you look at the really broad patterns, you say, well, 100 years ago, 90% of African Americans lived in the rural South and worked in sharecropping, tenant farming, or farm labor, primarily in cotton growing. And we're now in a completely different world. When you look 100 years ago, you see most women are not in the labor force. And here we are having a conversation, you know, between the two of us, and I'm a woman in the labor force. And when we look back 100 years ago, we see, you know, very few migrants from Asia, from China and India, from Latin America in the US. And now, you know, we haven't had a chance to talk about your background, but I'm assuming that you might have some family history of immigration along those lines. And so there's been so much change that's actually personal in my life, personal in your life, and probably in many of the other students at LSE and people who might be listening. When you think back to what your grandparents' life would be and what your life is now, that's what gives me hope.
Thanks so much for your time, Professor.